Tehran urges the UN to condemn the terror attack on its top nuclear scientists and the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani. Australia's ex-army chief says the country's top military brass is responsible for crimes committed by Australian troops in Afghanistan. Talks between Britain and the European Union on a post-Brexit trade deal remain deadlocked over European fishermen's access to UK waters. It's good to have you with us. Starting up with our top story, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has called on the world body to condemn the assassination of high-profile Iranian military and scientific figures. Majid Taftamanchi dismissed as blatant terrorist crimes the assassinations of Lieutenant General Soleimani and top scientist Fakhrizadeh. He says that these crimes must be condemned straightforwardly and without any reservation. The senior diplomat also underlined that Tehran should be able to reap the economic benefits of the 2015 nuclear deal. It says that the Europeans had promised to guarantee the continuation of economic relations with Iran envisaged in the nuclear agreement. He also noted that Europe's mechanism to facilitate trade transactions, known as INSTEX, should also prove its efficiency. Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad says that the West must correct its steady approach in the world. He made that comment in an interview in Moscow at the end of his official visit there. He said that the unilateral coercive measures taken against Syria are inhumane and can be classified as war crimes and crimes against humanity. Maqdad urged the United States not to look for its interests through inhumane methods that are considered in violation of international law. He stressed that the administration of the outgoing President Donald Trump has caused worldwide distraction. Political commentator Bijan Devasoli argues that the effects of the U.S. sanctions on Syria are tantamount to the effects of war crimes.
First of all, I don't think that the focus should be on the question whether from a formal judicial point of view, it has to be qualified as war crimes. The question to me is more whether the effect of the U.S. sanctions on Syria and other countries, whether the effects are the same as those of war crimes. And I think that question can definitively be answered with a clear yes. Because whether you kill babies and mothers with a bomb or with sanctions, it should not matter so much. And these sanctions are not targeted at military institutions. No, they target the civilian population. And so from that point of view, they kill innocent people every day. And I think it's correct to compare them to war crimes, because what else is it when you kill innocent people who have nothing to do with any armed conflict?
Including women and children, have been killed in an explosion in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Authorities say some 20 other people were also injured in that explosion west of the capital city. It caused damage to homes and several vehicles. A member of the Afghan parliament was the target. He survived the attack but sustained some injuries. Afghanistan has recently witnessed a wave of deadly attacks despite ongoing peace talks between the Taliban militant group and the government. On Friday, an explosion hit a religious gathering in Ghazni province, leaving at least 15 children dead and 20 others injured. No claim of responsibility, but a provincial police spokesman says that the Ghazni explosion was the job of the Taliban. Now, joining me to discuss this a little bit is Tim Anderson, director for the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies out of Sydney. Good to have you with us, Tim. As you know, I just told you about some violence and the bloodshed, and this has been going on for quite some time, and that's while so-called peace negotiations are also underway between the Kabul government and the Taliban. How can you square these together?
I think there is a leak. We don't know exactly who's responsible for this latest violence, but the U.S. has a record across the entire region of using proxies to try and leverage its influence in any sort of negotiations that they've created through the Saudis, Daesh, and through the Muslim Brotherhood allies, Jabhat al-Nusra and the other groups. We know that they've moved Daesh units into Afghanistan. Now, this doesn't discount that the Taliban might have been involved in this attack, but there are other proxies that the U.S. is using, and it's entirely in the character of their approach to things that they would be trying to leverage some advantage through violent attacks while they're carrying out talks. They don't really want to leave an independent and stable Afghanistan behind when the time comes for them to leave.
So, Tim, the question is peace and peace in Afghanistan. It's not only the Taliban, as you put it, it's also maybe some other groups like Daesh. So how will peace be restored to Afghanistan?
There has to be an independent country to deal with its own problems. It's simply not possible under a foreign occupation army for normality to come about. It's never happened anywhere. It's not going to happen here, basically. The U.S. has to be forced to retreat at some stage. And then the structures of society have to be rebuilt, indigenous structures of society. Now, the U.S. has aggravated the problems of Afghanistan in the last two decades, and it's only after the U.S. leaves that there's any possibility of restoring some sort of stability, some sort of normality.
Do you believe that the U.S. forces will be out of Afghanistan in time soon? Because President Trump talked about it. He even criticized his predecessor for that. But U.S. forces did remain in Afghanistan. Some of them left, of course, but some still remain there. And that's a big number.
That's right. But Trump has some support in some sections of the U.S. deep state, but not a consensus at this stage. Mm-hmm. Now, that consensus might be changing, and the incoming Biden regime is going to have to deal with what the new consensus feels about. Is there a need to strategically retreat in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, for example? That's the sort of thing that they will be discussing, but they will be forced to do it effectively. That they can't tell their home constituency that they're making progress when there is none to be made and when there are bodies coming home from those sorts of countries. So they are rather cynical. They would like other people to carry out the violence for them, other people to go home in body bags, but they certainly have no good intentions in terms of leaving behind a stable and peaceful Afghanistan.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments and contribution. Tim Anderson, Director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, joined us from Sydney with his comments. And that's the end of this news review. Let's move on with the rest of this news broadcast. The former chief of the Australian Army has blamed his country's top military brass for alleged war crimes in Afghanistan. Admiral Chris Barris says that Australia's military leadership is responsible for any crimes committed by troops in that country. Barris called for a royal commission to probe the allegations. A four-year investigation found evidence that Australian special forces committed dozens of unlawful killings in Afghanistan. The inquiry recommended prosecution for 19 current and former soldiers for suspected war crimes between 2005 and 2016. It determined that responsibility does not extend to higher officials, though. Australian activist Peter Pike believes that Australians believe that high-ranking military officials must be held accountable for suspected war crimes in Afghanistan.
I think a lot of Australians are becoming more aware of how Australian forces have been misused by the US and its allies in conflicts all over the world, in illegal wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, and even wider, perhaps in Syria. And we should come back to that. But as far as Australians thinking that it is the lower-ranking soldiers who are entirely responsible for these war crimes in Afghanistan, well, that's a nonsense. An Australian's believe in the fair go, and we believe that people all the way up the line, including perhaps the senior ranking military officer in Australia, must be held responsible for these war crimes.
Now, in other news, talks between Britain and the European Union dragging on into Sunday amid disagreements over European fishermen's access to UK waters. A British government source says the EU is making demands that are not compatible with Britain's independence. The source added the deal is not possible without a substantial shift from the bloc. But a European diplomat says that Britain needs to accept the last EU offer on fishing rights unless it wants a no-deal Brexit. The two sides must get a deal by December 31st. The European Parliament has demanded an agreement by midnight Sunday to allow time for review and ratification before the end of the year. A no-deal scenario would mean border chaos for both sides and reliance on World Trade Organization rules that could possibly lead to price hikes. The Netherlands has banned passenger flights from the United Kingdom as of Sunday, and this after British officials said that they have detected a new coronavirus strain in their country. The travel ban will remain in place until the 1st of January, the Dutch government saying it's considering additional measures regarding other means of transportation from the UK. It's already warned citizens to avoid non-essential trips. British scientists have warned that the new strain identified in the country is up to 70% more infectious. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced tough restrictions for London and South East England to prevent the spread of the new strain. The COVID-19 outbreak in Europe shows no sign of abating, several countries imposing new restrictions to curb the spread of the virus. France reported 17,000 new infections, pushing the tally to 2.5 million. The country has introduced nighttime curfews, delaying the reopening of cultural venues to curb the spread. Italy reported 16,000 new infections and more than 550 deaths. Italy has announced strict restrictions between Christmas Eve and January 6th. In the UK, Prime Minister Johnson has imposed a lockdown effective in Italy on almost 18 million people and reversed plans to ease curbs over Christmas.
First, we will introduce new restrictions in the most affected areas, specifically those parts of London, the South East and the East of England, which are currently in Tier 3. These areas will enter a new Tier 4, which will be broadly equivalent to the national restrictions which were in place in England in November. That means residents in those areas must stay at home, apart from limited exemptions set out in law. Non-essential retail, indoor gyms and leisure facilities and personal care services must close. People must work from home if they can, but may travel to work if this is not possible, for example, in the construction and manufacturing sectors.
The number of cases in England has soared in the last 2 weeks because of the virus variant. In Russia, COVID-19 deaths surpassed 50,000. The country also recorded 28,000 new cases on Saturday. The American biotechnology company Moderna has received the approval of U.S. health agencies to distribute its coronavirus vaccines. A panel of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention voted to recommend the use of the vaccine on people 18 years of age and older. The Food and Drug Administration had already authorized the emergency use. Moderna is the second company to get approval for its anti-coronavirus vaccine in the U.S. after Pfizer. The distribution of Moderna began Saturday, with thousands of sites due to start receiving and administering shots as soon as Monday. The United States is the world's worst hit country, having reported more than 17.6 million infections and 316,000 deaths. Let's take a look at South Korea. The country has reported a record number of new daily coronavirus infections. It registered as many as 1,097 cases on Sunday, pushing the total infections to some 50,000. The new cases included an outbreak in Seoul prison that infected 185 people. The overall COVID-19 deaths in that country is hovering around 700. Sunday was the fifth consecutive day that South Korea reported daily infections of over 1,000. Some medical experts have criticized the government for being slow to introduce tighter social distancing measures. The recent surge has heightened concerns as the country is running short of hospital beds. In Indian-administered Kashmir, the first major electoral process after the abrogation of Kashmir's specialist status has concluded. The elections were held amid tight security with fears of attacks by pro-independence fighters. The results of those local elections will be announced on the 22nd of December. Our correspondent there has the story.
Local elections in Indian-administered Kashmir held in eight phases have come to an end. The voting process has remained by and large peaceful amid stringent security measures. After the revocation of Kashmir's special status, regional political parties had refused to participate in the electoral process as a sign of protest against India's decision to strip Kashmir of its autonomous status. That resulted in the strengthening of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party in the Muslim-majority region. However, this time, the regional parties formed an alliance to take part in the local elections. Compared to the past, a large number of people came forth to cast their ballots.
Since the BJP came to power in India, it started taking decisions against minorities. The BJP has taken Kashmir's autonomy, Kashmiris' jobs, and now they are eyeing land. They don't care about the people of Kashmir. We came to cast our votes against those people who only aim to destroy Kashmir's ethnicity in the name of mainstreaming Kashmir.
More and more people in Kashmir have developed skepticism on the overall electoral process after scores of video interviews of the District Development Council or DDC candidates started circulating on social media. A number of candidates have no idea what positions they are running for in the local administration, and even worse, some have no idea what DDC means.
Kashmir, man. In order for votes to be equally distributed, the Election Commission has accepted nominations from all sorts of people. There is no set prerequisite for candidates. I wonder who they are empowering. How can an uneducated person with no idea of economy, finance, and politics seek equal rights and development for me? Basically, they do not need educated people. They want stooges who will implement what the Indian government will decide for us, without thinking about people's interests.
This is the first time that DDC elections are being held. Members of the DDC are expected to prepare and approve district plans and expenditure schemes, which will replace the district planning and development boards in all districts across the region. Earlier, district development boards looked after the planning, approval, or implementation of centrally sponsored schemes. The result of the eight-phase elections will be announced on December 22nd. Apparently, the elections in Kashmir have paved a way for other electoral processes in the volatile region. However, many say this ballot has made the people of Kashmir politically aware of the fact that New Delhi is trying to thrust such electoral processes in order to create an impression that normalcy has taken hold after it stripped Kashmir of its autonomy. Actually, without building trust and bridging the gaps. Shahana Butt, Indian administered Kashmir.
And with that, we come to the end of this broadcast.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back. We met Javad Qarai, an enthusiastic young nature explorer, and followed him as he discovered some of Iran's most unspoiled natural attractions in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. We visited the exotic Martian mountains with their peculiar shapes and ventured deep into the intertwining and spiral cave of the region. And finally, we joined Javad as he gazed into the mesmerizing waters of the Sea of Oman above the rocky cliffs. Stay with us as we further explore the wonders of the region and meet the kind-hearted locals.
The area is so beautiful and unspoiled. It is home to large flocks of birds, such as the cormorant sitting on the sandy beaches offering a scenic spectacle. It is the perfect place for bird watchers to come and feast their eyes on these exotic animals. Bird watching is a branch of tourism, or to be exact, ecotourism. Bird watchers are steadily growing in number. Cormorants are aquatic birds. They are medium to large in size, with a body weight in the range of 0.35 to 5 kilograms, and a wingspan of 45 to 100 centimeters. The majority of the species have dark feathers. They are excellent divers, and underwater, they propel themselves with their feet with help from their wings. Some cormorant species have been found to dive as deep as 45 meters. Cormorants nest in colonies around the shore, on trees, islets, or cliffs. They are coastal rather than oceanic birds, and some have colonized inland waters. Indeed, the original ancestor of cormorants seems to have been a freshwater bird. In my previous trips here, I saw large flocks of these beautiful birds here in this season, but this time there aren't so many of them. One of the reasons behind the decline in their populations is because some of the locals hunt and eat them. Although cormorants are not supposed to be eaten because they are carnivorous. According to some religious scholars, flesh-eating birds are not to be eaten. The flesh of carnivorous birds may contain many diseases that can be passed on to humans if eaten, but the locals are not aware of that. Those who hunt the cormorants do not do so because there is nothing else to eat, so they have no reason to kill and consume so many of these poor birds and do irreparable damage to the wildlife and environment in the region. The environment and wildlife are manifestations of God's beauty. How can humans, who consider themselves the greatest of creations, allow themselves to harm the manifestations of God's beauty? Human survival on the planet Earth inevitably depends on the environment and on the wildlife. Therefore, our country's officials should educate the local populations and make sure that the environment in each and every part of the country is well taken care of. This has been a very beautiful day for me. Berries is one of the most beautiful places I have visited, and I have visited many over the years. A day later, I'm on my way to a beautiful village in the heart of nature, accompanied by my good friend, Sheer Muhammad Rahul. To get to Shame Kohne, that's the name of the village, we have to walk a relatively long way surrounded by beautiful natural beauties. Near the village, we run into a shepherd named Sheer Muhammad, sitting under an old leafless tree by a pond. His is the simplest of lifestyles. The Baluch mainly speak the Baluchi language, a branch of northwestern Iranian languages. Experts say the Baluch language is very similar to that of the Medes, a people of Indo-Iranian origin, who inhabited the western and northwestern portion of present-day Iran. And that is a testimony to the deep roots of the Baluch tribe in Iran. Today, the Baluch people live in the southwest of Iran, the south of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Oman, India, the UAE, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Zanzibar. Borders between countries haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people at around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Sheer Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village. But even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan. But that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Gwadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Hara trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Hore Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a hur or firth, it's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Hore Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season, and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Guadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads, not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilay. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hotags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good, simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Sheer Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bash is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people, traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shah Bash. When I ask him if he's ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment, a place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I, too, am proud of these honest, kind people, proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment, created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.
Well, perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide, but I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Baluchistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Faith in Resurrection and Human Development. Faith in resurrection, besides logically interpreting and revolving the puzzle of life and death, and besides being a truth which must be accepted, produces diverse effects on human life, the most important of them being the following two. Number one, the picture of death, which had always been appalling and thought of which had always disturbed the peace of mind, has undergone a complete change. With the acknowledgement of resurrection and quote-unquote life after death, in a world where all the gifts of life will exist eternally, and on a higher and bigger scale, the picture of death is no longer as dreadful and appalling as it was, and the scenes of death and old age no longer disturb the peace of mind. The unrest and anxiety caused by the thought of death is not as painful to us as to the materialists, and thus we can lead a more comfortable and satisfied life. The believers in the life hereafter welcome sacrifice and martyrdom for a sacred cause, for they regard them as a prelude to a new life in a higher and wider world. So if you look at the state of mind of a materialist, you know, somebody who's immersed in materialism and whose worldview is that it's only matter that exists, okay? He's all about the material existence. He does not accept the metaphysical existence of beings. Consider the state of mind of such a person. What do you think goes through his head when you talk to them about death? Try it out amongst your friends. And then compare it with somebody who's a believer, who believes in Allah, who believes in hereafter, who believes that his soul is to stay, his spirit has to stay. Just do the comparison, and you would know that a believer
is always at ease when thinking about death.
Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing faith in resurrection and human development. And we made a claim before the break that faith in resurrection, besides logically interpreting and revolving the puzzle of life and death, and besides being a truth which must be accepted, produces diverse effects on human life. Okay? So we are proving that how it has positive impact on human life, how talking about and thinking about and believing in resurrection improves the quality of human life in this very world. The first point, we have made it clear to you that this acknowledgement of life after death is something that gives a soothing effect to a believer and the disbelievers, those who do not believe in resurrection and the day of judgment and that eternal life. They get baffled as soon as you start the topic of death, which is an inevitable reality, by the way. Now, point number two is the realization that human thought and deeds continue to exist, that they are going through a process of development and growth, come back in a magnified form in the next world, that all good and bad deeds are to be minutely accounted for, and that one has to receive reward or punishment, as the case may be, certainly exerts a healthy effect on human conduct and behavior. Thus, the belief in the next world creates a favorable atmosphere for the promotion of good deeds and keeping the outburst of passions under a strict check. Brothers and sisters, consider a disbeliever. What incentive do you think they have in performing a good deed? Well, almost none. They are not going to live. They don't have a life after here, so they're just going to work for their own personal benefit. Isn't that right? Their scope of their actions does not go beyond their own personal benefit in this temporary world. But when you talk to a believer, when you know the believer believes that their actions are going to continue to exist, they are, of course, going to work towards making this world a better place to live, a less selfish place to live, and a healthy place to live. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You heard was an IRIB English Radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.